Today's Teisho will be on Joshu's Four Gates. In the Heikigan Roku. Case number 9 in the Heikigan Roku is entitled Joshu's Four Gates. Engo's introduction. In the bright mirror on its stand, beauty and ugliness are revealed. With the Bakuya sword in hand, killing and sparing are brought under control. A handsome fellow disappearing, an ugly one comes. An ugly fellow disappearing, a handsome one comes. Life is found in death, death in life. If you have no eye to penetrate the barrier, no freedom to turn about, you will be lost on the way. Tell me, what is the eye that penetrates the barrier? What is the freedom to turn about? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. Secho's verse, its intention concealed, the question came. The Diamond King's eye was clear as a jewel. There stood the gates, north, south, east, and west, but the heaviest hammer blow could not open them. Thank you very much for coming to practice Zen this morning. Koan involves Joshu, whom we've met before in many koans. Master Joshu, Jiaozhou, was a great Tang Dynasty Zen teacher. And in this koan, a monk comes up to him and says, basically, what is Joshu? And Joshu gives this answer called the Four Gates, North Gate, South Gate, East Gate, West Gate. When we start practicing Zen, last night, for example, there were some new people here in the Zendo, and I was introducing Zen practice to them. And one of them is a very nice young man who has been reading a lot of literature on Zen and Buddhism, and also Tibetan Buddhism. And he was very excited, but he hadn't actually done much sitting. And he had a really hard time getting through two periods of meditation. So, you know, had read a great deal about all of this, and if you read the literature on Buddhism, it's full of stories of people sitting in caves and meditating for long periods of time. And he sat down on the cushion, and it was very hard for him to get through 25 minutes. And afterwards, he's such a nice young person. He had a smile on his face, and he said, you know. He leaned over to me and he said confidentially that his legs went to sleep. And I thought that was so cute because that's such a common problem. He seemed to be a little embarrassed by it. When you start doing meditation practice, it can seem insurmountable, right? I mean, I can remember myself when I first started doing meditation in Seattle with Genki Roshi, how difficult it was for me to get through a 25-minute sit. And, I would be sitting there maybe 15 minutes in, and, you know, some part of my body would hurt. So it might be my knee, or it might be my hip. And, you know, about 10 or 15 minutes in, I might be thinking, oh, this is going to be okay. And then, you know, 5 more minutes, and it was like, uh-oh, now I'm in trouble. And you know, I would be hoping for the bell to ring. And it took a long time to become comfortable sitting this way. And initially, if I had thought about it, it might have gotten discouraging, you know, because it just seems like, you think sitting for 8 hours, that's impossible. I can barely make it through 25 minutes. And there are other aspects of Zen practice that are like this too, not just a physical dimension. You know, we all have psychological barriers or obstacles, you know, that we have to overcome. And you can be practicing for a long time and still have barriers. Still have barriers. And that too can be discouraging. You know, it's possible that you might be sitting for 10 years and still have pain in your legs. You know, let me just tell you the truth, that's quite possible. And you could say, my God, I've been sitting for 7 years, I've been sitting for 8 years, and I still have pain in my legs, you know. And you can read about people like Xu Yun who could sit for days on end, and it might seem like a fairy tale. You know, this is impossible. And the same is true, for your mental situation. You know, you could be practicing Zen for 8 years, and you could still find yourself sometimes back in the same old loops. You know, the same old negative states of mind, or the same old fears, you know, same old compulsions or neuroses, you know, that you had 10 years ago, and you can say to yourself, you know, I've been practicing Zen for 8 years, I've been practicing Zen for 10 years, and I'm still as neurotic as I always was. And that's possible. I'll be honest with you, that's quite possible. It's an interesting problem, and people have maybe misconception about how practice is supposed to work, you know. In early Buddhism, people thought about it in a certain way, and I think we still think about it in a certain way. You know, so if you read the Pali Sutras, you will read about the Buddha leaving the lay life, leaving the life of a lay person, and going to live in a monastery. And he says, you know, the life of the person who owns a home and has a mortgage and kids and so on is a dusty life. He uses this metaphor of dust. He says it's a dusty life. You know, there's constant dust covering everything. It's hard to get free from all of that. So he puts all of that aside, and he goes to meditate on his own. You know, actually, he meditated with some very famous meditation teachers, but eventually he went to meditate on his own, and eventually he had enlightenment. And when the Buddha in the Pali Sutras talks about enlightenment, he talks about it as a kind of liberation from he uses the word taints, T-A-I-N-T-S, taints, you know. So you can have a piece of white cloth and you can stain it. You can, like, just the other day I was in my office and I was drinking coffee and I was in a hurry and I spilled coffee on my shirt. So that was a taint, right? My nice shirt, which wasn't white, it was navy blue, got coffee on it, and it was tainted, see? So the Buddha said, you know, basically we pick up these taints, and we have to free ourselves from these taints. And the enlightened person is somebody who is finally, it's like his cloth has been washed clean of all of these taints. And the Buddha goes into great length about, you know, the negative attitudes or negative habits, mental habits. You know, we all know them, right? Greed, the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion, right? If you're an angry person, you know, you can sit for 5 or 6 years, 7 years, and you can begin to feel like you're getting somewhere, and then one day, you know, some guy cuts in front of you in traffic and you find it's right there, you know, your explosive anger. You know, and you can just say to yourself, God damn it, you know, I've been doing this meditation for all this time, and yet there it is, it's still right there. You know, my taints. I've been washing this cloth for 7 years and I still have my taints, see. You could try another approach. You know, if you like to eat, and maybe it's hard for you to say no. You know, being attached to eating too much is that's a form of attachment. You know, the Buddha said you need to be unattached. You need to be free from attachments. So you know, you could put yourself on a very strict diet. You know, you could just, when you get up, you could have a little scale and you could weigh it. And you know, when you're hungry, you could say, no, you know, I'm gonna purify my mind, my body. I'm going to free myself from my taints, you know. And then you could find maybe all day long you think about food, you know. You think all day long, you know, you think about food because you're withholding the food, right? So, you know, early Buddhism understood the path as a gradual detachment from involvements with the world. This is not necessarily what the Buddha taught, but it's definitely how his followers understood him. And they also understood the path as gradually sort of getting rid of all of these characteristics which are obstacles to enlightenment. So it's like little by little the cloth that has all of these taints gets washed clean, and now it's just a blank cloth. You know, and so, you know, you could imagine that little by little, you know, you're going to get rid of all the mental habits you have that keep you from achieving enlightenment. And when you read about enlightenment in the Pali Sutras, it's very difficult to achieve. It's something very very hard. You know, the Buddha himself had to meditate for many years and go through great austerities before he has enlightenment. And when he has enlightenment, you know, he basically says that you know, I'm liberated from all attachments, is more or less what he says. You know, this. He says the roof beam that holds up my house has come down, and I will never be reborn in any future life. That's how he puts it. So, you know, it's possible to understand what we're doing as freeing ourselves from our obstacles, or freeing ourselves from our taints, you know. And it's possible to imagine that we have to give up one thing after another, or get rid of one thing after another, and gradually we're becoming like a blank sheet of paper. You know, it's like erasing all the writing on the paper, and we're going to eventually achieve that perfect blankness, right? And this is a common way to think. I think we all actually imagine, say, a perfectly enlightened person as somebody who has no negative characteristics, and maybe actually no positive characteristics either, you know, like a blank sheet of paper. When I first met my teacher, Genki Roshi, I've talked about him countless times, but I just fell head over heels in love with my teacher, you know. He had just come from Japan, and he was giving talks on Zen practice, and he seemed to be somebody who had, you could say, left behind all of his human characteristics. You know, he was invariably calm, gentle, kind, generous, you know, you name it. Nothing seemed to get under his skin. And when he meditated, he would sit for long periods of time. I remember our first sesshin, we rented a facility outside of Seattle. It's called Vashon Island. And it was pretty primitive, and many things went wrong, you know. But no matter what happened, you know, Genki would just, he was absolutely serene. He was very calm, very much, he seemed very much unfazed by everything that happened. And he had this extraordinary compassion. All of this was real. Real. The compassion was real. I just thought, that's what I want to be. I want to be like that, that kind of a person. When I started studying with Genki Roshi, I used to go into the Dokusan room with him, and I used to feel, I don't know how to put it, but it was almost like a sense of anxiety about myself. You know, I felt so far removed from his, to put it honestly, I felt so far removed from his state of mind. You know, because my state of mind was very different. You know, I wasn't always serene. I wasn't always calm. In fact, you know, often I was, you know, sort of like cracking up, you know. Things would happen and I would get upset, or I was fearful. I had a lot of anxiety. It didn't take me long looking at myself to feel that I was quite far removed from Genki Roshi. Genki Roshi would sometimes say, you know, he would say when we were in Dokusan, he said, you know, you don't really share with me, you know, to put it that way. He meant, you know, when you come into Dokusan, you're like a closed book and you don't open the book to let me see the pages, right? And I was ashamed to open my book and let him see my pages, because I felt so far from that ideal of an enlightened being, you know. And I've told this story too, but it just illustrates so fully how I felt about myself at the time. You know, I was coming out of class. I was a graduate student at the University of Washington, and I used to walk home by walking up University Avenue, which at the time was a wonderful place in Seattle. University Avenue was filled with all these interesting restaurants and shops for students. And there was an import shop called La Tienda, and there was a Chinese a restaurant that had a booth on the street, and you could get hanbao. And it was fantastic. It was like a circus every day, and it would really cheer me up walking home. I would walk home, and I would, you know, naturally, I was like 22 years old, and I would walk home, and I would look at all the beautiful girls, you know, and I wasn't on the street just to stare at girls, but, you know, part of the pleasure of walking down the street was just seeing one beautiful young woman after another. And I was looking at this particularly beautiful woman, and all of a sudden I noticed through the crowd that Genki Roshi was coming down in the other direction. And I felt so embarrassed that I jumped into a store, you know, because I didn't want him to see me, you know, in my, you know, basically lustful condition, you know. And I felt so ashamed of myself, right? You know, I thought, geez, you know, what, you know. When I look back on it now, I realize it's like comic. It's absurd, right? But you see this, you know, in Zen centers, you see this sometime where, you know, if there's tension, people have interpersonal tension, right? And people don't always deal with their interpersonal tension because they want, you know, so if somebody takes your tea bowl without your permission, let's say somebody comes to the sit, in our Zendo, we each had our own tea bowl. And, you know, basically, you were supposed to bring your own tea bowl and put it behind you on your mat. So, you know, some of us were regulars, and we would leave our cushions and our tea bowl on the mat behind us. And there were people who would come sometimes, and they would take their mat and their cushion and their tea bowl with them when they left. And some people would come, and they didn't know they had to have a tea bowl. You know, so a typical scenario would be somebody who's forgotten his tea bowl and he just grabs somebody else's tea bowl. You know, and then you turn and your tea bowl's gone, right? And, you know, your reaction might be, God damn it, who took my tea bowl, right? And, you know, and maybe it's the same guy every time. He's always taking somebody's tea bowl. And, you know, after the sit is over, you know, what you want to go up and say is, don't take my tea bowl, you know? Get your own damn tea bowl, right? But you say to yourself, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be like Genki Roshi. I'm never supposed to be mad, right? I'm never supposed to be angry. So you come up and you say, you know, gee, Bill, you know, is that my tea bowl? You know, and you know, over time, what tends to happen in these situations is that people become actually, you get explosive conflict because people can't be honest about their feelings, right? They're not honest with themselves and they're not honest with others. You know, so you let somebody take your tea bowl and you decide, I won't make an issue out of it because, after all, Genki Roshi wouldn't make an issue out of it. And then he takes it again. You say, well, look, there's the anger. I shouldn't be angry. I should be generous. It's just a bowl. It's not, you know, what, you know. Then he does it again. Finally, you want to kill him, right? And you know, just blow up at the guy, right? It would have been so much better if earlier it said, you're really pissing me off by taking my tea bowl. Case closed, right? But you want to be the perfect, you want to be just like Genki Roshi. Perfect, right? So, you know, this is a very common problem in Buddhist communities where everybody wants to be perfect. Everybody wants to be like the teacher, you know. But you know, actually, when I got to, I myself was like this, and I myself was involved in these explosive conflicts in our community, and we wondered, why are we having these explosive conflicts? And it was difficult for us to be honest about ourselves and honest with our failing, you know, show other people, you know, our loose ends or our rough edges, you know, that kind of thing. And I myself put Genki Roshi on a huge pedestal, you know, so, you know, basically, he could do no wrong in my eyes. He was like the Buddha himself, right? And by the way, he was a very wonderful human being, and he died a few years ago, but I loved him, you know, I loved him. He was a wonderful teacher. But, you know, he too had his rough edges. He had his stuff, you know. So, you know, I was able to keep my distance from Genki Roshi for a long time, but as I became his student for a longer and longer period, you know, I became a little bit more relaxed about sort of, you know, letting him see who I really was, although it took a long time, letting him see, you know, my neuroses, basically, and my fears, and so on. And you know, I eventually became Genki Roshi's attendant, and I began to see the real Genki Roshi, you know, behind the robe, so to speak. And, you know, Genki could be, you know, he had his own things. You know, he had his own obstacles and his own neuroses and his own, you know, he could be very, he could be really sort of like selfish or childish sometime, right? You know, one time, you know, he had a room that he liked. that was his private room in our Zen center. And if you would go into the room and he was there, you know, it was like going into a time warp, and you were in the 16th century in Japan. There were tatamis on the floor, and he had his, you know, he might be working on calligraphy, and he would have his brush stuff out. You know, there's a stone you use to grind the ink. Just like in Chinese, it's the same system. You know, you grind some ink on the stone, and then you add water, and then you have your brush and everything. And you know, I would come in, and there's this guy sitting on these tatamis doing calligraphy, and it really could be like the 17th century or the 16th century. He was, you know, it was this very traditional place, and he's a very traditional person. He had grown up in a temple environment. He wasn't really a modern person in a lot of ways. So anyway, this was like his inner sanctum, and you know, I would always knock on the door before I went in, and you know, he'd be there with, you know, like with a cat with a robe on, you know, his Japanese robe, not his priest robe, but his casual robe, and he'd have a fan, you know, like in ancient times, right? He'd be fanning himself and doing calligraphy, right? You know. Anyway, it was a wonderful thing to see, very inspiring, but his room, that was his like inner sanctum. So anyway, he was on vacation. He went back to Japan on vacation, and I was leading the sits in the morning, we had a pipe break, and the Zendo got flooded, and there were like 15 or 20 people there. And so, it was, I guess it wasn't that many. It was maybe like 10. But they had all come. You know, some people drove like 40 minutes to come to the morning sit. And so everybody had come, and the Zendo was flooded. And I had gotten there earlier, sort of cleaned it up and everything. But then I thought, well, where will people sit? So anyway, we sat in Genki's inner sanctum, right? Because that was the only available room, really, that was appropriate. And I thought, well, what the heck, you know, we'll just sit on these tatamis and we'll be done and we'll go. Anyway, when Genki found out about this, he went ballistic, right? You know, he was so upset. And I thought, well, you know, how petty of you, right? You know, all these people, they'd driven like 40 minutes or 45 minutes to come and sit, you know, and you get upset because we sat on your tatamis, you know. And we would have conflicts like that. You know, Genki Roshi could be very sort of like immature sometime. And it was a real shocker for me. You know, it was really difficult for me to, you know, this happens in some Zen centers, you know, or some Buddhist communities. You know, if the teacher is rather remote because of the size of the community or and so on, you know, or has a sort of personal style that's a little bit reserved, you know, it's often the case that people have this image of the teacher as like the Buddha himself. And then, you know, there, if you look at the history of Zen communities or Buddhist communities, sometimes there's like a rupture when the students begin to see that the teacher isn't perfect, you know, and people leave. It's like, what, you know, what a fraud this guy is, you know. He's got these flaws, or he has these. There was a very famous Zen teacher in Japan, Yasutani Roshi, and Yasutani was kind of an eccentric. And but anyway, he used to have his begging. You know, in Japan, some monks sometimes carry a begging bag. You know, originally you would have a cloth that you tied your shoulder, and at the end of the cloth was your begging bowl. But in some Japanese traditions, you have like a little satchel, and that's where you keep your personal stuff, basically, when you're in your robes. And Yasutani used to have in his satchel, he would have like a endless, bottomless pit of marshmallows, right? So he would eat marshmallows all day, and his student left him because he couldn't, you know, he was always eating marshmallows. And that sounds absurd, you know, but people put their teachers on a pedestal, and that means often that they have a very false view of meditation practice and the path in general, right? I would say, you know, one way of looking at ourselves is that we are basically not Buddha. You know, we're basically like anti-Buddha, non-Buddha. And our goal in practice is to go from being a very sort of like a bad animals to perfect beings. And the job of the bad animal is to get rid of all of the bad animal characteristics and gradually transform ourselves into like this angelic and perfect creature who is unlike us in every way, right? This is sort of like a common way of thinking, you know, certainly how I thought of it, you know, like I was an unworthy person who was often anxious and could get angry and had a short fuse, and Genki Roshi was utterly unlike me, right? And what I had to do was get rid of my bad, like curt characteristics and become Genki, right? And some of Zen discourse or some of Buddhist discourse encourages people to think this way, right? Basically the early language of Buddhism, the idea of taints, right? You're tainted. You have these bad characteristics that you have to get rid of. So Zen is about getting rid of your bad animal qualities, right? You know, detachment, and so on. This was a commonplace way of thinking in Buddhist communities too. You know, there's a very famous story about the sixth Zen ancestor, Wei Neng. And Wei Neng was an illiterate woodcutter who eventually was walking down the street one day and heard somebody reciting the Diamond Sutra. And when Wei Neng heard the words, form is emptiness and emptiness is form, he had a spontaneous kensho, a great awakening. It completely transformed him. He was taking care of his aged mother. And that's why he worked as a woodcutter. His father had been a literate person and like a minor bureaucrat, but had died, and he and his mother were living in very very difficult circumstances, and he had grown up just making money to keep everybody alive by selling and cutting wood. So as soon as his mother passed away, he went to a temple. A Zen temple, and because he was not a monk, he was allowed to come to the temple and stay, but he had to work in a lowly capacity as in the kitchen. And basically his job was to pound the rice, rice that had not been husked, it was like brown rice, pound it until the husk came off and it would be white rice, and that's what he did all day, sort of menial tasks in the kitchen. So, the fifth great ancestor was dying. He knew he was going to die. And he had quite a successful temple. You know, there were lots of monks training there. And the head monk's name was Xianxiu. And Xianxiu was an excellent monk. You know, really great, very accomplished, very well-read. Could sit for a long time. And the fifth great Dharma ancestor said, he didn't say I'm dying, but he said, it's time for me to pass on my robe and my bowl, my begging bowl, to my successor. So I want anybody who would like to come to participate, I would like you to write a poem that shows your state of achievement, shows where you are in your practice, right? And basically, I will look at the poem and I will know who should receive, who should be my Dharma heir, who should receive my bowl and robe. So in some versions of the story, there were multiple poems, and in some versions of the story, only Shensi wrote a poem because everybody thought he was the obvious choice. So, Shensi wrote his poem and put it on a pillar in the Dharma Hall for the fifth ancestor to look at. So the head monk wrote this poem, Shensi, the head monk, wrote this poem and put it on a pillar, and the idea was that the fifth ancestor would come out and look at it and say, oh, you've got it, here's the robe, here's the bowl, and now I can retire, see. Well, meanwhile, in the kitchen, Hui Neng was pounding rice, and he heard about this contest, and he had had a Daikensho, great awakening experience. So he said to the monk, the head monk in the kitchen, I'd like to participate, I'd like to write a poem, but I can't write. Would you write the poem for me? And the monk was apparently a very kindly person and said, sure, I'd be happy to do that for you, you know. So he took dictation and he wrote the poem and he put it on a pillar in the Dharma Hall. So anyway, the fifth ancestor comes out and he looks at Shen Xue's poem, the poem by the head monk. And Shen Xue's poem says, the mind is like a mirror, and our job is to keep cleaning away the dust. See, cleaning away the dust. And when we clean away the dust, the mirror essence shines forth. And the fifth ancestor read that and nodded in agreement. You know, that's a very deep understanding of who we are. Our Buddha nature is clouded by obstruction, right? Dust. Remember the Buddha said, I'm getting out of a householder's life because it's too dusty. So dust is on the mirror, see? So anyway, then he went over and looked at Wei Nang's poem, the illiterate woodcutter's poem, and the poem said, you know, there's no such thing as a mirror, and there's no such thing as dust. From the beginning, not a thing exists, not a thing is. See, fundamentally, emptiness. So when the fifth ancestor saw this, his jaw dropped, right? And he said, okay, contest over, I'll be out later. And he went into his room. And everybody thought, well, what was that all about? So anyway, the fifth ancestor stays in his room until nightfall, and then he sends a messenger. He says, go get that cook out of the kitchen, or that cook's assistant. And Wei Nang is brought in, and the fifth ancestor says, you have the deepest understanding of the Dharma. Shen Xue is excellent, but you've gone a step beyond Shen Xue. And so I'm giving you my robe and my bowl, but you have to leave here because people are going to be so mad at you and they're going to be so jealous. You know, your life is going to be hell. Take these and go. And so Wei Nang goes. That's the story. And Wei Nang really becomes, according to the legend, becomes the founder of what we know as Zen today. So, you know, I think there's a really important lesson in all of this. You know, we tend to think about Zen practice like Shen Xue. We're going to get rid of our dust and we will finally be pure. But, you know, actually, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Because, you know, our obstacles are also pure. See, this is very hard for people to appreciate, but our obstacles are also pure. And our obstacles are all of our obstacles are doors to enlightenment. Your anxiety can lead you to enlightenment. Your anger can lead you to enlightenment. Your jealousy, envy, lustful, all of these things can lead, are like doors into enlightenment. See, this is really like advanced teaching. But it's so important to understand that, here's an example. You know, when people sit down on the cushion and they watch the breath, you know, they sometimes misunderstand me. They think I say, try not to think. Try not to think. But I'm not saying that. What I say to people is, when you start to think, turn away from your thoughts and go back to the breath. See? I don't say try to get rid of your thoughts, because actually the more you try to get rid of your thoughts, the more tenacious they become. You know, if you just keep coming back to your breath, after a while the thoughts just come and go. And in fact, if you try to focus on a thought, it quickly disappears. You know, so whether you are, you know, eventually it's possible to be in a thoughtless state on the cushion. But when you're watching your breath, even if you have thoughts, it's not really a problem. Unless you're afraid of having thoughts. Because the thoughts quickly dissipate and become unimportant. I wonder if this is making any sense. But it's like people say, oh my God, I fell asleep on the cushion. It's like, how was it? You know, because you don't stay asleep on the cushion very long. And sometimes, even in a state of like very sort of sleepy drowsiness, your mind on a deeper level is awake. You know, so one way to think about Zen practice is that you're a bad animal and you're trying to become a Buddha. But another way to think about Zen practice is that everything is coming out of your Buddha mind, even your thoughts, right? And so, you know, if you just settle down on the cushion, you watch the breath and you grow calm, you gradually go down, down, down through the layers of the mind, and the mind becomes luminous and bright, you know, on its own. Sort of like the mind is naturally Buddha. Naturally Buddha. And so, you know, Zen practice is not really about progressing from bad animal to enlightened being. It's really about allowing ourselves to be who we really are, what we really are, you know. So, you know, even our neuroses, even our fear, and even our anger are doors into Buddha nature, you know. If you feel yourself on the cushion having thoughts, and you become worried about the thoughts, they become this terrible obstacle, you know. And you can get off the cushion and say, oh my God, you know, when am I going to have a blank mind? When am I going to be in the thoughtless state? There are actually people who respond to practice in this way. You know, they come to me in Dokusan and they say, you say you're in blank mind, but my mind is never blank. You know, I'll never be enlightened. But it's like, so your mind is never blank. So what? You know, just keep watching your breath. Your mind will clarify by itself. Even your anger has a bright dimension. You know, anxiety, fear, all of these have, you could say, a bright dimension. If you sit with your anger long enough, it turns into something else. If you sit with your anxiety long enough, you notice your mind becomes bright and full of energy. How is this possible? See, how is this possible? You know, what we do when we find ourselves feeling anger, or when we feel anxiety, Other emotions too. You know, we want to create a separation between ourselves and those emotions. But it's probably more constructive to realize that, you know, those emotions have, you could say, like a bright dimension, a bright aspect, you know. So all of the things you experience on the cushion, you could say, all of them are manifestations of enlightened mind or expressions of enlightened mind. You know, so really the best way to practice Zen is to sit down on the cushion, watch your breath, and just have a kind of embracing mind, right? You're watching your breath, and then thoughts arise. It's not a problem. You know, if you try to stay with your thoughts, you won't be successful. They'll just go away again. And new thoughts arise, and that's not a problem. And they'll just go away again. If you keep coming back to the breath little by little, you know, even very enlightened people like the Dalai Lama don't always sit in a thoughtless state. That's just one state. There are many, many different mental states that are accessible to us. And one way to think of them is to say, well, only a few of them are enlightened. But the Zen view is that all of them have, you could say, a bright dimension. A bright dimension. You know, all of them are, you could say, Dharma doors into awakened mind. So, you know, when a monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? You know, Joshu could say, I used to be a bad animal, but now I'm, you know, a Buddha. And little by little, I got rid of all my obstacles. But, you know, Joshu probably still has obstacles, so to speak, right? Joshu still has... You know, maybe Joshu likes to eat too much, or maybe Joshu gets too excited when women come to the temple and he flirts with them, or maybe when food is being passed down, he always takes the last piece of rice in the bowl or something like that, you know. So, it's possible Joshu has qualities... That we would think of as not Buddha-like. But, you know, the Buddha, his way of practicing, you could say, is not to worry about it, but to trust himself. You know, he trusts himself. All of your mental phenomenon have a bright dimension. All of them are leading you towards that brightness. Even your anger, even your fear, if you sit with your fear, it turns into something else. If you sit with your lust or your envy, it turns into something else. Yeah. So when the monk says, what is Joshu? He doesn't say, I'm a great Zen master. He says, I'm an open gate or open gates. Let me put it a little differently. Every barrier is a door. Every barrier is a door. See? And it's a different way of thinking about Zen practice. On the simplest level, you know, when we have, when you have pain, you know, in your legs, you may or may not be able to get over it. But, you know, when you're sitting with your pain, when you get off the cushion and you stretch out your legs, you realize your mind is often incredibly calm and bright. You know, you realize that through this whole process, you've been in this very deep state, you know. All of your mental phenomenon are fundamentally Buddha nature. And somebody like Joshu has cultivated a deep trust in that truth. You know, Joshu has his own issues. He has his own so-called obstacles. He's created his own karma, right? But he also knows that all of his obstacles are doors to enlightenment. So, you know, if there's an art to practicing Zen, it's learning not how to overcome our obstacles or erase our obstacles, but how to use our obstacles to connect ourselves with our fundamental nature, which is Buddha mind. So, you know, I have known, you know, there was a very famous person in Japan whose name escapes me right now, but he was very famous in Zen circles. And he actually had a drinking problem. And he was famous because, you know, he was it sounds impossible. But he had a drinking problem, and he also was deeply enlightened. Person who started Los Angeles Zen Center, Maizumi Roshi, also had a drinking problem. My second teacher, Webb, was a very good friend of Maizumi, and Maizumi's alcoholism was not a good thing, right? It was not good for him. But nevertheless, you know, Maizumi was also deeply awake. And, you know, I myself don't drink. And I don't eat meat, and I try to follow the precepts, you know. And I think everybody should. But when people hear about Maizumi Roshi being an alcoholic and also being deeply awake, that seems to be impossible, or it seems to mean that he wasn't really deeply awake. Or you think, well, what is being deeply awake? Another example is somebody like Trungpa, Chogyam Trungpa, you know, who was also alcoholic and deeply awake. Now, I definitely am not recommending that you become an alcoholic as a way to become deeply awake. You know, please don't do that. I myself follow the precepts. I really believe in following the precepts, right? You know, your obstacles can open up into your fundamental nature. It doesn't mean if you're deeply neurotic you shouldn't go to therapy, because you should. And if you have anger issues, you should take an anger management class, yes. But all the same, you know, your anger can open up into something really quite wonderful. You know, your anxiety is, you know, anxiety is a wonderful dharma door that will take you to very deep places if you don't worry too much about it. Trust your true nature. In the bright mirror on its stand, beauty and ugliness are revealed. Out of enlightened mind comes beauty and ugliness. With the Bakuya sword in hand, killing and sparing are brought under control. A handsome fellow disappearing, an ugly one comes. An ugly fellow disappearing, a handsome one comes. Life is found in death, death in life. If you have no eye to penetrate the barrier, no barrier to turn about, you will be lost on the way. Tell me, what is the eye that penetrates the barrier? The barrier is the eye. What is the freedom to turn about? See the following. Main subject, a monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, East Gate, West Gate, North Gate, South Gate. Setcho's verse, Its intention concealed, the question came. The Diamond King's eye was as clear as a jewel. There stood the gates, north, south, east, and west, but the heaviest hammer blow could not open them.